Previously on Beta.
Plagiarism. 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 Did you get it? Let me know in the comments.
So did you watch Harry Potter growing up?
No, bro. Witchcraft.
So what did you watch? VeggieTales?
Physically flawless, grade A carved man meat. Come on. And 9 times out of 10, this dude's description includes the line, he could have any woman he wanted. Any of them? Are you sure? Because I don't know if anyone told you, but some women like women.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, comedian Maggie May on her journey from the Rio Grande Valley in Texas to Los Angeles.
And I grew up just kind of feeling like I was just a little bit different from everybody else, not necessarily just because of my race. I mean, I felt different from my siblings. I just kind of felt like a little bit of an oddball.
Also, the world's most popular authority on the art of story, Robert McKee.
So, for example, Larry David and Curb Your Enthusiasm as an obsession with propriety. He believes there's a certain way to behave in public that other people just don't seem to get.
But first, Stephen King says that The Plot is one of the best novels he's ever read about writers and writing. He also boasts that it's insanely readable. Jean Hanf Korelitz is the author of The Plot. It's her 7th novel. Jean's previous novel was adapted into the HBO series The Undoing. It starred Nicole Kidman, Hugh Grant, and my fellow Canadian Donald Sutherland. The Plot is on the same trajectory. It's a thriller topping almost everyone's must-read lists. It features a down-and-out writer turned professor who steals an idea from one of his most hated students. Jean says she was so delighted to hear Stephen King add The Plot to the list of great stories about writers and writing.
I read any and all novels about writing. We're such a navel-gazing people. You know, we always want to know if we're an aberration or if other people are experiencing the horror that we experience when we attempt to do what we do. But I think the real secret anxiety of the author and is that we ourselves are plagiarizing without knowing it because we are readers. All writers are readers, or I should say all good writers are readers. And we've been doing it back to the cradle, or, you know, as near enough. All of that language is jumbling around like a big, you know, drying machine or a cement mixer. It's all in our heads. What we read this morning and what we read under the covers with the flashlight at camp, it's all mixed up together. And sometimes when we write ourselves, that stuff just comes out and we don't know always where it came from. And there's a terrible fear that we are ripping somebody off, you know, that we didn't write that sentence, that we didn't come up with that idea, that character that we're writing sounds awfully familiar if only we could remember where we thought about that kind of a person before. And so there's this understanding that we are, you know, sitting on the shoulders of everyone who came before us, and that's not a bad thing, but also that we may inadvertently be copying somebody's language, and that is a really terrifying thing. So that when, you know, whenever we publish a book or put our language out into the world, somebody somewhere is going to read it and say, I wrote that, or you didn't write that. And it's so funny and kind of meta, but I've actually been keeping a list of some of the things that people have accused me of stealing the plot from.
Really?
You know, movies, TV shows, other novels. A lot of them I've never even heard of, so I feel like pretty much in the clear. But others, you know, there definitely are elements that I've come across before. I certainly did not invent the character of a writer who is afraid that he has stolen from somebody else.
And I suppose then we now have to ask this question. How did you come up with the idea for the plot?
The plot is my 7th novel. And I mean, everyone has been different, but only once before have I had this experience where an idea from one second to the next, you know, went from not being there to being there. The previous time that this happened to me was with my novel, You Should Have Known, which was adapted as The Undoing. That That idea came out of nowhere, and this idea came out of nowhere, but the context is slightly more convoluted in that I was in the middle of another novel, a very different novel that was not working, and I was struggling with this book, and I was literally in the middle of a meeting with my editor at which she was explaining to me why she was not buying the book. And I said to her, and I said this, and I heard myself say it, and I thought to myself, I cannot believe I'm saying this. But I said to her, well, I have this other idea too. And I just kind of upchucked this whole story about a writer who has a student who has this brilliant idea, and then he dies without writing his book. And the writer takes his idea and writes a hugely successful book, but he can't enjoy it because he's afraid that somebody will accuse him of having taken it. I mean, he doesn't copy any language, but he does take the idea. Well, then I told her what this plot was, and that's when her jaw kind of hit the floor. And I really don't know where it came from. I mean, I've written novels that literally took 20 years of thinking about before I wrote the first word, but not this time. It was just there.
Yeah. Can you tell us a bit about your protagonist, Jacob Finch Bonner?
Jake is all of us. He is a failed writer. And for people who never heard of me until Nicole Kidman was on their TV screens last fall, and assume that I've always been this wildly successful novelist, you know, I've been asked, well, what do you know about being a failed writer? And the answer is plenty, because, you know, it's been a very long slog. But certainly all of the writers that I know, and I should say particularly the women, we all carry Jake around with us. He's ever present, and he's our kind of nightmare of failure.
Mm. Yeah, and Jake is teaching creative writing at this third-rate MFA program at Ripley College in northern Vermont. And then one day, this student named Evan Parker walks into Jake's class. Can you tell us about Evan?
Evan is, I mean, I've never taught creative writing except once in an extension course at the University of Massachusetts. But even in that one experience, and I think I had four students, one of them was this guy who just glared at me through the whole class and with this expression of, who the hell do you think you are? And, you know, I have now confirmed that that guy is in every single creative writing class. And that is Evan. He thinks he knows everything. He doesn't need to be there. He doesn't have any time for his classmates. He has no respect for his teacher. And why is this guy who's never published a word so arrogant? It's because he has this plot that he describes as a sure thing. Nobody can teach him anything. He doesn't need anybody. So he's a real jerk. And Jake knows he's a jerk, but he's curious. He certainly would like to know what this great plot is.
Yeah. And Evan is so cocky and arrogant that he's already picked out what his pen name is going to be when his best-selling novel is published. What is it?
His real name is Evan Parker, but he's going to be Parker Evan when his massive bestseller is published for privacy. And Jake just wants to say, you know, hey, for the rest of us, the privacy is usually thunderous.
Mm. Since the plot is your seventh novel, I'm guessing that you have no plans to adopt Corliss Jean Hanf as your pen name.
No, I'm not. I think I'm pretty stuck with my name as it is.
Oh, yeah.
I'm happy with my Hanf because I had a distant relative named Helene Hanf who wrote 84 Charing Cross Road. And that's an important book for those of us who love books. So, I mean,
yeah,
it is
definitely
my middle name. It has been since birth. But I was quite embarrassed about it when I was in high school. Everybody had middle names like Cindy and Lisa and Susan. And I had Hanf, but I'm happy now.
Right. And well, you should be. And Parker Evan, I loved how you, well, see, I'm using his pseudonym already, but I loved how for a while in the book there you would go Evan Parker / Parker Evan. What,
right.
what does Evan Parker tell Jake about the plot of his novel?
Well, he only shows us a few pages of text. It's part of his application material or part of what he submits for the class. So Jake only sees a few pages of text, and he doesn't keep those pages. So when he does begin to write his book, he's not copying anything. And he actually, you know, because he's a pretty honorable guy, well, that's debatable, goes out of his way not to replicate anything that he can remember. He's really writing an entire novel from his own imagination, but it follows the story. And we don't reveal a lot of the story at the outset. And there's not, you know, we're only going to gradually have this plot revealed to us, but it does involve a mother and daughter who do not get along very well and live in a rural area. I think, you know what, that's really all I can say about it.
Yes, yes, we don't want any spoilers, yes. We want this to be a spoiler-free interview. We don't want to ruin it for people right. who haven't read it yet. So a few years go by, and Jake is waiting for the publication of Evan Parker's debut novel. What happens next?
Well, Jake has slid even farther down the food chain. He is not even living in New York anymore. He's been forced to leave New York. The MFA program has closed. He's sort of cobbled together a career as a literary coach, and he's working at a writer-subsidized artist colony. He's really just clinging to the fringes of his former life. And one day he thinks, you know, why did I never hear about that novel? And he Googles his former student, Evan Parker, and he quickly discovers that Evan Parker has died, and not even recently. He's died not long after their encounter at the MFA program. In other words, there's no novel. There's certainly not a finished novel. He has no way of knowing how much of the novel Evan Parker managed to write before he died, but there is no novel. So he writes the book. He writes his own novel with this story, and it's called Crib, which, as you know, has two meanings. It's where you put your child, but it also means to steal.
Mm-hmm.
And he writes Crib, and Crib becomes everything that Evan Parker said it would be, a massive, massive bestseller.
Mm-hmm. 2 million copies in 9 months, and Steven Spielberg buys the film rights. That's very
That's
good.
Right.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
Was the success that Jake experienced from Crib based on your past experience with your own bestsellers and adaptations?
What happens with Crib is like nothing that has ever happened to me. I mean, I've had a wonderful, wonderful publishing experience with the plot. It's certainly been my most successful book. But, you know, there were times when I was writing the book when I thought, am I making this too successful? At one point I have him in a theater with 2,400 seats, and I said to myself, you know, is this a little too much? Am I just throwing my fantasies now at Jake's experience? And then I would remember Gone Girl, you know, mm-hmm. Gillian Flynn at the height of Gone Girl would absolutely have filled a theater with 2,400 people. David Sedaris still does. So it's very rare, but it does happen. It has never happened to me. Nothing like what happens to Jake with his
It novel. Still could, though. There's still time.
Well, as we used to say in the shtetl, from your mouth to God's ears. But I would not say no if it happened. I would be very thrilled.
Yeah. I loved that you included excerpts from the novel within the novel, Crib, that Jake, quote unquote, wrote. It seems to me that you try to write these excerpts in a different style from your usual writing style in the rest of the book. Would that be fair to say?
Absolutely. In fact, when I first turned in the novel, none of those excerpts were there. And that is because while I was writing the book, and I wrote the book entirely during the pandemic last spring, I happened to hear a podcast with the novelist Lily King, who had also just published a novel about a novelist. And the interviewer said to her, well, you know, did you consider giving us a little taste of the novel that this character is writing? And she said, no, I thought about it, but I decided that nothing I could write would be good enough to justify how well this fictional novel does. And I thought, great, if Lily King's not writing hers, I don't have to write mine. And I said to my editor, you know, when she said, where are the chapters of the novel? I said, well, Lily King's not writing hers. I don't have to write mine. And she said, no, you have to write yours. So then I had to go back and, I mean, I knew what Crib was about. I knew what happens in Crib that makes it so incendiary. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It was like having to write a whole second novel. New characters, mm-hmm. new places, new everything. Mm-hmm. So I wrote all of those chapters afterwards, and then I kind of filleted them into the book.
filleted them. I like that. Great use.
Well, I mean, because every one of those excerpts is a clue. I mean, as we read more of the crib, we understand more and more what is happening to Jake.
Has Steven Spielberg optioned the plot yet?
No, it has been optioned for television. Sadly, I cannot say anything about it because it has not been announced yet. I wish it could.
If you don't mind me asking, you probably can't reveal this, but are you going to be involved in the adaptation in terms of writing the script?
Actually, I can say that's probably the only thing I can say. It was something I really, really wanted. I've never done that before. I always want to learn. I mean, learning new things is the most important thing that I can do. And I said to the producer, I want to be part of the writing team. And they said, yes, so I will be part of the writing team. But, you know, on one hand, I'll be the expert in the room. But on the other hand, I'm going to be like the intern. I mean, because I've never done this before.
Yeah, but that'll be good. As you say, that'll be good. It'll be a good challenge to learn new things. That's important
Absolutely.
For writing. Yeah. Jean Hanf Corlitz, thank you very much. It was so great to talk to you. And congratulations again on the plot.
Thank you, Doug. I appreciate your inviting me.
Jean Hanf Corlitz is the author of the insanely readable novel, The Plot. You can find out more about Jean and The Plot, but not everything, at wpr.org/beta.
And so with things that are sensitive and things that, you know, people have the potential of getting kind of up in their hackles about, you just have to really delicately ease someone into it.
Comedian Maggie May joins us in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Comedian Maggie May is sometimes described as a funny, smart weirdo. She takes that as a compliment, and rightfully so. Maggie says that her fly style is one of the things that sets her apart. She is definitely a comedian to watch and listen to. Maggie's expecting big things from herself, and so are we. We caught up with Maggie at her home in Los Angeles to talk about her journey from small town Texas to the bright lights of late night, and to find out what she loves most about being a comedian.
Making people laugh is the thing. It's the most fun. As a kid, I was always trying to make people laugh. That's all I wanted to do, is just make people happy for that moment. You know, I'm not thinking that I'm making someone happy for the rest of their life, but like just for that moment in my sphere of influence, I'm able to make them feel good or forget about their problems. Like, that's always been what I've wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. And by doing that, making people feel good and happy, that obviously makes you feel happy and good, right?
It's fun to do. It's just so fun to like see someone laughing and having a good time and knowing that you are part of the reason why that's happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very heady feeling. You grew up in the Rio Grande Valley in Texas, and you were the only Black kid around. How did the other kids treat you?
Well, I guess after the fact, I'm able to see things a little bit differently. But at the time, I didn't really think that if I did encounter anything, it was a microaggression from usually a kid who didn't know any better, sometimes adults. But it was definitely a situation where I recognized I was different from everybody else.
You see, I got called sassy a bunch growing up. I'm from the Rio Grande Valley. I was the only Black kid growing up. No one was really racist to me or anything. They were super pumped to have a Scary Spice for their little skits.
I just always kind of understood that how I was and like the upbringing I was getting and my point of view was going to be very different from people who did not have my same upbringing, did not have, you know, my same origin, I guess.
Mm-hmm. A lot of comedians identify as outsiders. Do you think that being the only Black kid may have had something to do with your decision to pursue a career in comedy, being maybe that you felt like an outsider?
I don't think that being the only Black kid was the catalyst for it. I also don't think that that was the only thing that made me different. In high school, I had a professor, Dr. Bolte, and one day he was just like, Maggie, there is no rubric for which we can measure that you would be considered normal. You are not the normal height. You are not the normal size. You're not in normal range of intelligence. You're louder than normal. Like, everything about you is different, you know? And I grew up just kind of feeling like I was just a little bit different from everybody else, not necessarily just because of my race. I mean, I felt different from my siblings. Like, I just kind of felt like a little bit of an oddball.
Right. How did that make you feel, though, when he told you that you were different in all these ways?
At that point, I was really proud. You know, as a kid, you want to fit in. You know, I had moved from kind of northern Texas to south Texas, and I didn't really understand, you know, how that was, and I was different from everybody else. And there's a period, I feel, with children where they just kind of want to fit in and kind of want to see if people can understand them as they are and just try to be part of the group and try to be quote unquote normal. But the older I got, the more I was just like, I'm not going to fit in. Like, this is just not going to happen. So I should just embrace what makes me myself and be happy with that. At a church camp one time, I had a friend who had a word from God for me. And she said, "You are surrounded by clay pots. Everyone is a clay pot, and you are a jeweled pot. And while you're a jeweled pot, you know, you're wonderful and you're brilliant and you're great, but in being a jeweled pot, you're never going to fit in with the clay pots."
Mm.
I would say that was something that I was just like, I'm going to be different and I need to embrace that rather than try to pretend that I'm the same as everybody else.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, the fact that you embraced that was like a good thing, probably made your life easier, that rather than trying to be someone, be sort of a false self and try to fit in with others, don't you think?
Right. You know, when you let your freak flag fly, other freaks are like, oh, there's one of us. And you find people who you're supposed to find, and you find your tribe, and you're never going to be happy unless you just own what you are.
Mm. Yeah, that's very true. Very true. Very well said. There wasn't much of a comedy scene in your hometown. So I'm curious, how did you start developing your stand-up chops?
See, I didn't start stand-up until I moved to Austin, Texas. I graduated from college kind of early and I didn't know what to do. And so I just went to another college and started doing prerequisites for pharmacy school. And then I moved to UT because I wanted to go to the UT pharmacy school. And I got into pharmacy school in a small North Texas town and had to make I just had to be honest with myself that I really did not want to be a pharmacist. I just really enjoyed Ted Leo and the pharmacist. And this was not going to make me happy. And I had moved to Austin because I had hoped that I could do pharmacy on the side, you know, but it's like, why would I spend, you know, 3 or 4 years in school where I can't go and do acting things, or I can't go do comedy kind of things? Like, I can't do any of that. I'm going to be concentrating on school, and school is not even what I really want to do.
Mm-hmm. I've read that you often tell yourself that the material you write isn't good enough, yet when you tell that material on stage, it kills. So I'm curious to know, how loud is your inner critic?
Oh, that bitch is loud. I don't know if I could say that, but she's loud. I am always analyzing things. I didn't start comedy for a long time because I was like, there's no way I'm good enough to go to an open mic. And now you go to an open mic and you're like, wow, this is really just the wild, wild west. Anybody can be here and do whatever they want. But starting out, I was just like, oh my God, I've got to be professional if I want to go to this free sign-up open mic and be able to tell my little jokes as well. I'm kind of a perfectionist and I have kind of a high standard, which I've heard, I don't remember who exactly said this, but it's like when you have a high standard and you know what you could be capable of, or you know how good a joke possibly could be, or how, you know, when you've experienced and watched other people do like really good jokes and really well thought out jokes, and you see that it can be really, really, really wonderful. And then you see the things that you're doing, you're like, wow, this is good, but there's a whole nother level of stuff out here that I'm not achieving, you know? And I think that discrepancy is what sometimes makes people feel like they're not good enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how did you manage to overcome your inner critic to feel good enough to perform? Was it just a matter of, like you said, sort of pulling yourself up by the bootstraps and just performing and realizing that at first you weren't going to achieve the goals, you know, that you set for yourself?
When I wrote the set, like my first set, and I'd written sets and I'd just be like, ah, that's not good enough. And I wrote sets and I'd be like, this isn't good enough. I need to work on it. And I never did. But this particular day, I wrote a set and I told myself in my head, this is funny, but it's not good enough. I need to work a little harder. I need to practice a little bit more before I go to this open mic. And just clear as day, a voice in my head said, if you don't do this now, you're never going to do it. Just clear as day. And I was so scared that I would never do it. Because, like, I'd always wanted to, you know, that's always something I'd wanted to do. And I was so scared that that voice is right, that I would never do it, that I looked up an open mic that day and called in and signed up for it.
And how did that set go over?
In the moment, I thought I killed. I was just like, oh, my God, this went so well. Like, it was way better than I thought it was going to be. For some reason, I thought that, like, people were going to hate it or whatever. And it's kind of weird. Like, the first time, I kind of thought that people were just being nice to me because it was my first time. Mm-hmm. And then the second time I was like, people are just being nice. Like, there's no way that this is good. And it wasn't until I did a big show. They had a contest in Austin, Funniest Person in Austin. And I did that contest my first time. And I was able to see, oh, wow, some of these people are just getting no response. Like, people are not out here trying to make people feel okay about themselves and about their sets. People are just responding normally. And that show, I mean, it went over like gangbusters. And I was just like, oh, my God, I guess maybe I'm funny and people aren't just trying to, like, you know, make me feel better.
You appeared on Conan O'Brien's show a few years ago. Can you walk us through that experience?
That had to have been the best day. It was such a great day. The thing that was, I guess, the most present for me was that I didn't have anything else in my mind other than that. Like, everything went seemingly perfectly.
Oh, man, it's funny the kind of things that you'll notice when you're actually paying attention. Like, you'll notice not all inspiring phrases are inspirational. Like, you've all heard the one, dance like no one's watching. Someone probably put it on your Facebook wall with butterflies trying to inspire you. It's not inspirational. Like, that phrase literally says, hey, you should be yourself, but in private. Like, you should be yourself regardless of who's there, regardless of who's watching. That is the point. They should change that phrase, I think. They should change it to, dance like you are not the father.
And back in Austin, I saw pictures later of, like, three different watch parties at, like, my favorite bar was one, and at some restaurant, and then at another bar that was close to where I hosted an open mic. And so that was also, like, for me, just an eye-opening kind of thing of like, oh, wow, I'm part of a comedy community and we all very much love and respect each other.
Yeah, that's great. That's fantastic. One of the things that really struck me about your set on Conan was the way you told these very smart jokes about racism.
People will use the word racist to describe when a white person does black people stuff. How is it racist for a white person to do black people stuff, but it's not racist to think that there's black people stuff?
What is your creative process like to approach such a sensitive topic?
Well, there was a comic once that said that it's hitting a target without letting people know that you're hitting that target or that you're aiming for the target. And so with things that are sensitive and things that, you know, people have the potential of getting kind of up in their hackles about, you just have to really delicately ease someone into it. The point is to get someone to laugh at what you're saying, to listen to what you're saying and laugh at what you're saying. They can't laugh at you if they don't want to listen. So you just got to put it in a way that they're listening and they're not feeling, you know, self-conscious. They're not immediately defensive or anything. You just have to do it in such a way that you get them to listen and hear and they're laughing before they realize that, oh gosh, there was something else behind this that I needed to understand.
You also perform sketch comedy and improv. How does stretching those creative muscles influence your stand-up?
I feel like just doing comedy in general, doing any sort of type of comedy is going to help other types of comedy because you're in that headspace. You're always in the headspace of like, let me create something. If you're writing a sketch, you're like, okay, well, let me paint this world. What am I going to do to make this come alive? How am I going to make this character to be a live character and not just something flat? So when you do stand up, essentially some of your jokes are like storytelling. And so it's that same concept of like, how am I going to build this world? How am I going to get people interested in this story? How am I going to add little jokes around what I'm trying to explain so I keep them engaged? It's staying in that comedy headspace and realizing that there are different ways that you're going to be able to flex that comedy muscle.
Okay, there is some real gritty white out there. Like, I've dated a lot of, hey, I play bass in a corn cover band kind of ones. My type is red flag. I'm into that. Man, I'm from Texas. I have dated a lot of, hey, I fist bump my daddy on Christmas kind of white. That's gritty white, that's sexy to me. I'm into that kind of thing. Like a dude that, like, you get a car with him and like he gets pulled over, he backhands the cop and you still don't go to jail. Like, that's exciting to me. Like, just that intersection of white privilege and poverty, that is a fun intersection to be in.
What is next for you?
I'm working on a lot of writing for myself, things that I'm trying to take out of conception and put it into reality.
Mm-hmm. Execute.
That's what I'm trying to do. Right, right. And I'm really working on honing my acting chops and like going, you know, back to class and everything like that. Because I want to be on a show. I like performing. I think that would be a great next step for me.
Yeah, I agree. Because you have a great presence. You're different.
Thank you.
Which is, yeah.
Thank you.
I mean, you're different, which is a good, which is a bonus. And in this world, it's hard to be different. So, yeah. So we'll look forward to whatever comes next. I really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you very much, Maggie Mae. Thanks for the great conversation.
I had a great time with y'all. Thanks for having me.
Maggie Mae is a stand-up comedian, sketch comedian, and an improviser. You can find out more about Maggie and her comedy at WPR.org/beta.
I went to see the screenings, one of the early screenings, with my son. We came out and I said, Paul, what'd you think? He said, Dad, he nailed you.
That screenwriting expert, Robert McKee, on seeing his adaptation in the film, Adaptation. He joins us next to explain why complicated characters are the future of prestige TV. Coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The last time makes a film. Wow them in the end, you got a hit. You can have flaws, problems, but wow them in the end, and you've got a hit. Your characters must change, and the change must come from them.
If you've seen the Spike Jonze movie Adaptation, you probably remember that scene. It features Nicolas Cage and Brian Cox. Cox is playing the preeminent story authority, Robert McKee. Robert McKee is based on the real Robert McKee. He's one of the world's most popular authors and lecturers on the art of story. The list of people who have attended his seminars include over 70 Academy Award winners and 250 Emmy Award winners. Now Robert is back to talk about characters. Did you ever wonder why Tony Soprano, Don Draper, Walter White, Beth Harmon, and even Larry David are so magnetic? Robert knows why, and he analyzes it in his book, Character, The Art of Role and Cast Design for Page, Stage, and Screen. We caught up with Robert to talk about why characters are becoming more complicated, what it was like to see himself adapted to the screen, and to find out what is more important, story or character. Or as it is better known as, Aristotle debate.
And the Aristotle debate is what is more important as in writing, the story you tell or the characters in the story. Aristotle said story, and the character was second to that. And then over the centuries, it got reversed, and people said, no, what people really want are wonderfully complex, fascinating memorable characters, and the story is just a clothesline to hang them on. And on it goes. The truth is that it's a ridiculous question to begin with. Mm-hmm. You can't ask the question, what's more important, story or character, because they are the same thing. They're just two sides of the same coin. They cannot be artificially separated, as I do in my books, in the writing, because a story is a sequence of events, right? And an event is a choice that some character or characters make to take an action and cause reactions in their life and their world. And as they choose to act, they are dramatized as human beings. Who are these people? The kind of people who would make those choices and take those actions under those circumstances. That's who they are. But people like to argue.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. So what do you want your readers to learn from reading character?
Complexity. Today, especially, and into the rest of this century and beyond, the demand on writers will be to explore human nature in greater depths and greater complexities than ever. And one of the reasons that that demand is being made is because writers are now given more time than ever to tell their story. If you wrote a play for hundreds of years, you had something like 2-3 hours, or if it's Hamlet, 4 hours, but generally 2 hours to dramatize characters. 2 hours isn't very much. Long-form television now is virtually unlimited. So instead of 2 hours, you now have 80 hours. Instead of a cast of 6 characters, you now have casts of 60 characters. And what holds people to watching over long periods of time like that are two things. Revelations of character, discovering season after season aspects of the character you've never seen before, taking them into more complexity, and change. In a long-form television, a three-dimensional character is at best a supporting role. Characters like Walter White are 16-dimensional. Tony Soprano is 12-dimensional.
Forget about the way that Tony Soprano makes his way in the world. That's just to feed his children. There's 2 Tony Sopranos. You've never seen the other one. That's the one I want to show to you.
So that's why I wrote the book. For everyone, no matter what medium they want to write in, to create more complex, but true, of course, not just gimmicky, but truly deep characters, and to open themselves up as writers to the dark side of human nature, mm-hmm. because that's where the complexity will come from.
Yeah, you draw on Matthew Weiner's groundbreaking TV series Mad Men to illustrate how these various selves are used to flesh out the lead characters of the series. Can you kind of walk us through how these apply to John Hamm's character, Don Draper?
Yeah, well, I also, they had a system, you know, sitting, you know, 10 writers sitting around a room. When discussing the characters, that somebody would say, well, that's, you know, that's their personal self, but when they're in public, they behave. And then I added to that the subconscious self that they may have thought about, but they didn't actually talk about in their discussions of how they wrote it. And Don Draper's secret was that he stole his identity from a dead lieutenant during the Korean War in order to escape the war. His subconscious self, does he find life meaningless? He's a very successful ad executive, a star at the agency. He's got a beautiful wife, children, the whole perfect package, and he finds the whole thing pointless.
I'm not the man you think I am. I broke all my vows. Scandalized my child. Took another man's name and made nothing of it.
And so the whole series is about Don Draper's brilliant public success, his failed marriage and family, his personal disasters, But what's driving it is a quest for meaning, for finding purpose in life. And by the very end of the series, he does actually, I believe, find his meaning when he comes to realize that being a superb ad executive is meaningful. He's really, really good at it. And for a human being to be able to do at least one thing really, really well that makes a difference in the world, adds to the lives of other people, is a good thing, is a meaningful thing. And so he's a wonderful character.
Oh, definitely. And very, very complex and very dimensional. In a section about true character and free will, you reference an iconic scene from the great British sitcom, Fawlty Towers, which was created by John Cleese and Connie Booth. Can you tell us about this scene and how it connects with your thoughts about character and free will?
Comic characters, what makes a character a comic character is that they have a desire, something that they want, extremely that they want, but they are blind to it. It's what we call a blind obsession. So, for example, Larry David, the great Larry David, in Curb Your Enthusiasm, has an obsession with propriety. He believes there's a certain way to behave in public that other people just don't seem to get.
I don't quite get your point. All right, Weatherman, I'm going to tell you my point. I've got a sneaking suspicion that you're predicting rain to clear the golf course for yourself.
Oh my God.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, ridiculous. Come on. Ridiculous.
It's the
happened
weather.
Before, weatherman. You know it. And you know what? I'm calling the weather people.
You're going to say, report me because it's a nice day?
I'm going to report you because every time you want to play golf,
Larry,
you make sure that it's raining.
Larry, first of all, I'm not a weatherman. I'm a meteorologist. I'd appreciate a little bit of respect.
Excuse me,
Larry.
Doctor.
Come on, can you guys just calm down? We're in the middle of a game of golf here.
And so John Cleese in Fawlty Towers is an incompetent perfectionist. He wants perfection, but he can't achieve it because he's incompetent.
Yes.
And so his car breaks down. Another imperfection. Probably because he doesn't bother to, get it serviced. And he talks to the car. And he says, I've warned you many times. And this is the end. This is it.
This is it. I'm going to give you a damn good thrashing.
And he rips a branch off a tree and beats the paint off the fenders of the car. So, we see he's crazy.
Definitely. Yeah. And as you point out, the relationships between characters play a huge part in the success of any creative fictional work. Can you talk a bit about how the character relationships contributed to the success of Vince Gilligan's Breaking Bad?
Well, it's an enormous cast to begin with. And the key is you design a cast like that based on the principle that you do not treat different people the same. And so when you create a cast full of different kinds of people in relationship to the central character, every time any two characters meet, they bring out qualities, distinctive qualities, in each other. And so you have to design a cast that's designed to exploit and explore the dimensions in each other. You don't want a character having the same relationship and the same behavior with two or three other people. And one of the most important qualities of relationship, maybe the most important, is power. And so when two people meet and there's rarely a balance of power, one has more or less than the other. And as a result, their behaviors become whatever they become because of the difference in power.
I want there to be no confusion. I know I owe you my life. And more than that, I respect the strategy. In your position,
I would have done the same.
And so you try to build a cast amongst other qualities of intimacy versus, you know, social relationships. But anyway, you try to build a cast with always with an eye to the power relationships, because they're a key to, one key at least, to behavior.
Yes, most definitely. So speaking of characters, you had a chance to see yourself as a character when you were famously played by Brian Cox in the movie adaptation. What was that like, and how did that character work for you?
Well, you know, when they came to me, they had to have my approval for all this, of course.
Right.
And so I got a call from Ed Saxon, the producer, and he says, I've got a problem. I've got this writer. He's written a screenplay, and he's made you a character in it. He has freely stolen dialogue out of your mouth and your book, and we don't know what to do. And I said, well, send it to me, and I'll see what. So they sent it to me, and I could see what Charlie Kaufman was up to, and so I saw what he was up to. He wanted to use my character to represent Hollywood, as if Hollywood as some sort of oppressive force that eliminates creative choices in artists, and I read the screenplay, of course, and I realized, well, this screenplay needs an antagonist because otherwise it's just a story about a guy suffering writer's block, and who cares about that? And so he wanted me to be the antagonist and the force, the commercial force of Hollywood, which is false. But I thought, it's okay. I said, but A, I need my redeeming scene, and I need control of the casting. And so I said, I want you to send me a list of 10 actors that you're considering, and I will try to guide you toward who I think would be best. So, because I couldn't be sure, was this the, what their school of casting would be? Is this the, you know, Dan Aykroyd, Danny DeVito school of casting, or what? And so they sent me a list of the 10 greatest British middle-aged actors alive. And from Michael Caine to, you know, Terrence Stamp, everybody. And I said, I see what they're after, some sort of gruff professor type. And, but there was a name that was not on the list. And that was Brian Cox.
And God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing. Any idiot can write voiceover narration to explain the thoughts of a character. Okay, that's it. 1 hour for lunch.
All these other actors, you know, like Christopher Plummer, all of them are all wonderful, but in most actors, no matter who they're playing, good guy, bad guy, no matter who they're playing, there's always this subtext of love me, love me. You know, they're always, actors want to be loved.
Sure, right? Just like people.
Yeah, of course, yeah. But I knew that Brian Cox, because I had seen Brian work in the West End of London, and I knew that Brian Cox would not do that love me subtext thing, because I do not want to be loved. I want to be respected.
Yeah.
But I do not want people following me like some guru.
Right.
I went to see the screenings, one of the early screenings, with my son. And we came out, and I said, Paul, what'd you think? He said, Dad, he nailed you.
How did you react to that? Was that good or bad?
I thought that's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
And it was, I realized that in my dealings, certainly when I'm lecturing, there's an intensity that most students have never experienced from somebody giving them a lecture.
Do you really hate the use of voiceover as much as Brian's interpretation of you does?
No, that's always been, I never said I was categorically against voiceover, the way Charlie Kaufman wrote the dialogue to put in Brian Cox's mouth.
Yeah, I didn't think so.
What I've always said is that the substitution of voiceover storytelling for dramatization, that is really shallow.
Find an ending. but don't cheat. And don't you dare bring in a Deus Ex Machina.
Whoops, we're out of time. How's that for Deus Ex Machina? Robert McKee is the author of Character, The Art of Role and Cast Design for Page, Stage, and Screen. Find out more at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Jean Hanf Korlitz, Maggie May, and Robert McKee. If you want to hear it again or catch up on past episodes that make long drives and tedious housework more bearable, Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Just search for WPR and Beta. And you can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
If I stopped putting things off, I would be happier.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Why should I be made to feel I have to apologize for my existence?
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
I need to read more, improve myself.